Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. In the fall of 1975, a man who would become president of the United States a little more than a year later, peanut farmer and past Georgia governor Jimmy Carter, answered questions from the La Crosse media on Newsmakers. We're marking the 40th anniversary of Newsmakers by featuring a pair of interviews from the 1970s on today's show. 14 months before the 1976 presidential election, Jimmy Carter was asked to assess his chances of becoming president and to assess the chances of other leading Democratic candidates.
Well, I fully intend to win. I'm not going to withdraw. I'm not interested in being vice president. I'll be there when the last vote's counted at the convention. I think it would be a political miracle to have a deadlocked convention. We've not had one in the last more than 50 years, and not even a threat of one since we changed from a two-thirds rule into a 50% or majority vote requirement for the nomination. I don't see anybody now in the political scene that I think can beat me. I have a total commitment to the campaign. I have scheduled, for instance, this year outside of Georgia, 250 days to campaign. I've already campaigned in 43 states. The first delegates will be chosen in Iowa. A recent poll there, rather in April, showed that I was ahead of all the other candidates. The second and third states will be Oklahoma and Mississippi. All this will be during February. And then we come to the first primary state, which is New Hampshire. And I would say there it's a race between me and one other candidate. In Florida, which would be very important, it's a race between me and one other candidate. And I would say that coming out of Florida primary, which will be quite early, March the 9th, as has been the case in the past, there won't be more than three of us still left who are politically alive. And I certainly expect to be one of those.
Who are the other two?
I think Wallace will still be a candidate. Wallace was a candidate for president in 1964 and lost, in 68 and lost, 72 and lost. He'll lose in 76. There's no chance that Wallace will be on the ballot itself. Last election, 1972, Wallace carried every county in Florida, 67 counties, and got 41% of the votes, and then came to Michigan later and got 51% of the votes. So that'll be a very severe test. Wallace can't win overall, but he can very well be a formidable opponent if he should do well in that early test. Who the third one would be, I really can't say. At this point, I don't know who's going to stick to it. It may be Udall, it may be Benton, it may be Jackson, it may be Shriver, or it may be Bayh. It's just hard to say at this point. But I think that by the time we've gone through those first five or six states, and before we get to Wisconsin, which is on April the 6th, it will narrow down between me and one other person, plus Wallace. I would guess that Wallace, if he's still able, and I presume he will be, would be a candidate in 1988. He's a perennial candidate. He has a very tight-knit group of very dedicated supporters, about 20% plus or minus 5%. He has the ability to raise large sums of money. He spends very little, as you know, in the campaign. You never see a Wallace billboard or television spot. And he is a perennial candidate. I think it would be about a 50-50 chance that before the convention is over in July, that Wallace would be a third-party candidate.
Patricia Love, Channel 19 News. Your key campaign promise seems to be a consolidation of federal agencies, similar to what you say you've done in Georgia. Now, how do you propose to do this, through a merger or by a process of elimination?
Well, I would expect to pattern it to some degree after what we did in Georgia, which was a complete elimination. We had 300 agencies and departments in the Georgia government when I was elected, and we abolished 278 of them. We cut administrative costs more than 50%, put into effect a unique budgeting system that we've had now for 4 years called zero-based budgeting, where we strip down to zero each year the Georgia government, start from scratch, and we eliminate every program that is no longer effective almost automatically. And also we put into effect a long-range planning system which has let the Georgia people control after understanding the government. And the same mechanism would be used. What I would like to have and what I expect to get his authority from the Congress to reorganize the executive branch of government subject to subsequent veto by the members of Congress. This is feasible and urgently needed, and I think would be a very attractive thing to the electorate in 1976. I have an advantage in having been through the process myself as an engineer and a scientist and a businessman. I happen to be the only candidate who is likely to run in 1976, by the way, who's not a lawyer. And I think it's time for someone to get in and have a competence and a complete total dedication and a campaign platform promise substantiated by election in 1976 that I will do this. There's no doubt in my mind that it needs to be done. There's no doubt in my mind that it can be done.
How much money, Governor, would you think that this could save the American taxpayer?
Well, the first year that I put into effect in Georgia, we prepared two budgets, one with the same level of services, I might add, one with the old structure of the government and the other one with the new structure of government. The difference between the two budgets was $60 million, which was about 6% of our total state budget. I think this would be a possibility in the federal government after we've had, I'd say, by the year 1979. You can't do it instantaneously. But there's a real possibility of cutting back administrative costs to the government substantially. And that, in Georgia, amounted to about 5 or 6%.
Do you feel your lack of foreign policy experience limits your insight into the difficulties of the presidency in any way?
No, I would not defer to any of the other candidates in my knowledge of foreign affairs. All my adult life, I've been an active traveler around the world. For instance, in the last 2 or 3 years, I've been in 11 foreign countries on official visits to meet with people like Dr. Helmut Schmidt in Germany, or Mr. Rabin or Mrs. Meir, or Mr. Eben or others in Israel, and to meet with Mr. Miki Tanaka and others in Japan and so forth. I've visited the Far East and Middle East, South and Central America, and Europe. In addition to that, I've had very good experience in working with the leading, I'd say, opinion shapers in the international field. I probably have as good a group of advisors on foreign affairs as anyone has ever had, possibly since Franklin Roosevelt's time, in domestic and international matters. And I think I have a good knowledge of foreign affairs. I don't know, you know, all there is to know, obviously. But compared to other candidates who are running or who might run, I would not defer to them in any way about my knowledge of foreign affairs.
In a speech you gave last December, you seem to advocate a strong domestic policy on the part of the American government and then say that they should really concentrate on their foreign affairs secondarily. Now, I think that would be a good idea, and according to what other presidents have said before they got elected, so did they. So I'd like to ask you, why do you think you can be different?
Well, there are two or three premises that I think can be detected in the analysis of our past experience. First of all, we haven't had a governor elected president since Franklin Roosevelt. And right now, with the Vietnamese War over, there's not nearly the preoccupation with foreign affairs that there was in 1968 or 1964 or 1972. Even among those who are crucially interested in foreign affairs, there's a general belief that the best way to effectuate any sort of viable foreign policy is first to get our domestic house in order. So the American people once again trust government, so the government is competent, well organized, and so we have clear policies. We have no foreign affairs policies that anybody can understand. In our dealings with Japan, or the People's Republic of China, or South and Central America, or the African nations, and we've had a debilitating series of blows to us that have been brought about by several, I think, misapplied foreign policy commitments. The major thing is that the American people have been excluded from participation in the evolving or the carrying out of foreign policies. There's one other aspect of foreign affairs, and that is that there's a growing realization, even among the most isolationist groups of people, that our country cannot withdraw from an active leadership role in foreign affairs. Every decision that's made in the community of nations affects everyone in this room and everyone who's listening to this program. In areas like freedom of the seas, a stable economic structure, an international monetary fund, food provisions, the acquisition of scarce commodities, including oil, bauxite, molybdenum, zinc, cobalt, and so forth. Almost every aspect of life
on an international scale affects everyone in Wisconsin or in Georgia or California. So we can't withdraw from a leadership role. The rest of the nations look to us as a natural leader. I think our leadership in the future, though, has got to be based on a few different premises than in the past. For instance, we ought to have our influence in the world affairs based not on military might or political power or economic persuasion, but on the fact that we are right and honest and decent and open and truthful and compassionate and predictable. That the foreign policy of our country accurately represents the character of the American people. Also, it ought to be a bipartisan approach. In addition to that, we ought to avoid, like a plague in the future, the military involvement of our country in the internal affairs of other nations, unless our own security is directly threatened. And I personally believe that we have excluded our own natural friends and allies and trading partners from a close relationship with our country by an overemphasis of détente. I certainly want to have a maximum interrelationship with Russia and China and other countries so that we can understand them and they can understand us. But to subjugate our natural friends, say in South and Central America or Europe, to Russia or China, in my opinion, has been counterproductive. So there are a lot of things that we can do in foreign affairs field that would restore confidence in our own government. The main thing, though, is to have the American people and our own character be exemplified in foreign affairs for a change, which it hasn't been in recent years.
You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. We're marking the 40th anniversary of Newsmakers in the La Crosse area with a 1970s interview featuring then-presidential candidate Jimmy Carter.
Governor, you mentioned cleaning up our domestic house. Two of the main problems we have right now are grain sales to Russia and busing.
Yes.
Would you answer how you would propose to clean up the busing issue and the grain sale issue?
All right. Since they're not related directly, I'll take them one at a time. I'm not in favor of forced busing. We've been through this traumatic and very challenging decision-making process in the South for the last 15 to 20 years. I think the best thing that ever happened to the South was the integration of our schools and the granting of complete citizenship rights to our minority citizens and the passage of the Voting Rights Act. It removed from around our necks an albatross or a millstone of racial prejudice which had existed for many years. And this has been a liberating experience for us and the white people and for the blacks. So far as I know, in this whole country, every civil rights leader who has so far expressed a preference has endorsed me for president. So I'm completely acceptable to those who are very militant on the subject of racial equality. But I think busing is the wrong approach to it. Voluntary integration in the South has been a notable achievement. I have a 7-year-old daughter who was born after we had been married 21 years. She goes to a typical South Georgia school, very conservative area, rural area. I'm a farmer. But Amy had a classmate analysis last year, 13 white classmates, 18 black classmates, a black teacher, a white principal, and she's getting a superb education. It's what I prefer. She can read the New York Times or the Milwaukee paper, whatever, without any problem. But when we have gone to the proposition of forcing children to be bused away from their own home or local community, schools, to a distant school, it's been counterproductive. It's resulted in either whites moving out or the rich people putting their kids in private schools. You never see rich children get bused. Just the poor kids, black and white, get bused. We've worked out a system in Atlanta that has worked with our very militant black leaders like in the NAACP or SCLC and the white leaders as well. It has four simple elements, and I can be very brief. One is any child that wants to be bused can be bused at public expense. Secondly, that the busing must contribute to increased integration. You can't be bused away from a school just because it is integrated. Third, the black leaders must be adequately represented in the decision-making processes of the school system to assure the black kids are not cheated. And fourth, no child is bused against the wishes of a child. This has worked for us, and I think it would be a good approach to the busing system. I'm not in favor of forced busing. On grain sales, to change the subject, we've got to have aggressive sale of grain overseas. Mr. Butts has been a very detrimental factor in the economic structure of agriculture, and also he's had a tendency through his inept leadership to separate the consumers of this country from the family farmers. In my judgment, what is best in this nation for the family farmer is also exactly what's best for the consumer in the long run. But this insight has been lost. A lot of people in this country don't realize that every year, with a normal harvest, we have to export two-thirds of all the wheat we produce. We can only consume about a third of our total wheat. So we've got to have an aggressive sale of wheat overseas, plus soybeans, plus rice, plus tobacco, plus corn, and so forth. This is crucial to us. It's also our best export item, and we have a flexibility now to produce more products for export. But they ought to be done under tight constraints. In 1972, Mr. Butt sold too much grain overseas. The only people that benefited were the grain speculators and the food processors and the Russians. Certainly we did not benefit. The farmers did not benefit. I don't think that would be repeated. We now have a much more careful monitoring system over sales to Russia. I would not sell additional wheat or grain to Russia until we are sure that our supplies domestically are okay and adequate. And I would also not sell grain to Russia in preference to our natural friends and allies like Japan and Europe and other countries who are regular customers of ours every year. But after those needs are met, I would sell grain on a competitive basis to any country overseas. It's got to be done.
It's rumored that U.S. negotiators are in Moscow now negotiating a wheat for oil, oil for wheat deal. How would you feel about that?
Well, that's just a paper shuffling deal, to which I don't object. I think to sell wheat for gold is a pretty good bargain. But I think Russia ought to pay top prices. As you know, in 1972, we really paid Russia to take our wheat. And a lot of the wheat that we sold them at extraordinarily low prices with government subsidies, I might add, was then sold to countries like Japan and India that didn't have enough wheat because we were so ill-advised in what we did. But I think for either gold or currency based on gold or oil, all of those are equivalent. I think one thing that we might do is to level off the violently fluctuating orders of Russia for our wheat. They have in the past only bought wheat when they had a crop failure in Russia, like this year. I think we ought to require them to buy wheat on a long-time competitive basis, and I would certainly get top prices for them with currency that can be equivalent to gold.
Would you comment on Kissinger's Arab-Israeli plan, which calls for civilian American civilian advisors in the Middle East?
Yes. I know Mr. Kissinger very well. He's been to Atlanta to visit me and my wife. He and Nancy have, and I've had long discussions and debates and arguments with Mr. Kissinger within the last 7 or 8 months about different aspects of his foreign policy. Some things that he does I really like. He's a brilliant personal negotiator. I think Kissinger is quite often inclined to create a much greater disturbance that would ordinarily exist and then have the appearance of being a savior for mankind with a highly publicized unilateral approach to diplomacy. He's excluded the American people, the Congress, Democratic and Republican leaders, I think sometimes possibly the president, from the process in order to look like the savior of the world. I think he's also much too inclined to get us militarily involved in the internal affairs of other countries. He's much more inclined to want to favor highly publicized examples of the success of detente than to have a stable approach. He's also much too inclined to spend his time outside this country. But I think in this particular instance, between Egypt and Israel, he's done right to go there. Both sides want him. I think the most explosive potential area of the world is in the Middle East, in Israel. And I think through his repeated, very tenacious approach to this problem, he's worked out a fairly good solution. I don't know the details of it. Nobody knows yet. But I would personally favor the sending of the 150 to 200 non-armed forces technicians to man those lookout posts, which will use infrared and radar-type surveillance on both sides. They are isolated from both battle lines. Both sides want those few technicians to be there, and I think that's a very small price to pay and a very slightly dangerous price to pay for the possible solution to the Middle Eastern problem, at least for the next 2 or 3 years. I believe they would be heavily protected by Egypt and by Israel. So I think that I would approve in this instance, the sending of those technicians. My personal preference, by the way, would be to send someone from the United Nations or from Sweden or Norway or Switzerland. But my understanding is that both Egypt and Israel have insisted that they be American citizens in order to be trustworthy. And another thing is that this greatly enhances our posture in the Middle East, I think with very little danger, in fact, a slighter danger of our being involved militarily in those affairs.
Governor, a lot of people up here are worried
about natural gas shortage this winter and probably some of the next winters. And some of the energy-producing states, Texas, for example, just passed a law prohibiting natural gas sales to other states until all Texas needs are clearly met. Now, what are you going to do to resolve this inequity between energy-producing and non-producing states?
Well, let me digress just for a minute to say something that's politically important. President Ford has been a totally inadequate leader. There has been no leadership qualities exhibited by President Ford since he's been in the White House, except in one area. He's been very effective in pursuing an energy policy for this country. He's just a spokesman or a mouthpiece for the major oil companies. There's no way to tell where the Federal Energy Agency starts and the oil companies start. They're the same people. President Ford's energy policy is very simple and very clear. Raise the price of oil and gas as much as possible, as quickly as possible, period. That's it. This works into the hands of the major oil companies. I would not have deregulated and would not deregulate the price of old oil and natural gas. Secondly, as they become inherently and inevitably scarcer, those supplies need to be distributed by government interference, if necessary, equitably among the states to make sure that this very same thing that you point out does not occur in the future. We're going to run out of oil and gas very quickly. We've now got about 30-year supply of oil, for instance, in the whole world. At the present rate of consumption, it's going to be much more scarce in the future, and we're going to have much more critical needs for it. The deregulation of oil and gas does not help us at all. The domestic price for oil and gas overall has been, oil at least, has increased 200%. It's tripled in the last 2 years. International prices have more than quadrupled, as you know. And the price of new oil discoveries is still uncontrolled. So I think to have a better energy policy for this country would be to develop one for the benefit of the consumers themselves and not just the oil companies. We need to shift from oil to coal, distribute scarce and scarcer supplies equitably among the states, hold down the price of oil, for instance, and gas goes with it, at least $3 or $4 below international oil prices, freeze the level of present oil imports at about 40%. 2 years ago it was only 25%, and have strict conservation measures.
Can you beat President on economic policies, and if so, how and where?
Well, I think so. You've seen President Ford's status or popularity drop precipitously since he became president, and especially the last 2 months. I think he started off with a very highly rated opinion among the people. That's now dropped down to about 35%. 60% of the people that were polled by Gallup and Roper and Harris recently indicated that Ford was not capable of solving their economic problems, with an opinion with which I agree, by the way. So I think that by the time next year comes around, Ford is going to be quite vulnerable to someone like me who can tie together the various elements of the Democratic Party in a common effort. Ford has been compared so far in integrity with Richard Nixon, which would make anybody look good. And he's also been compared, as far as executive leadership is concerned, with the Congress. And this would also make any president look good. But when Ford, and he still only has a 38% favorable rating among the voters. So by the time next year rolls around and the Democratic convention chooses myself, hopefully, as a nominee, he'll have to face me personally and not capitalize on his relationship with Nixon and the Congress, and also debate the specific issues on which he has been so inept. So, yes, I think I can handle him very well.
How are you going to solve the economic problems? What's your solution?
Well, of course, it's hard to describe in a few seconds how I'll solve all the economic problems, but I'll tell you briefly what needs to be done. The first emphasis needs to be placed on unemployment. We'll never have a balanced budget, which I really would expect to try to get, nor an end to the inflationary spiral, as long as we've got 8.5 or 9 million people out of work who are actively looking for jobs, plus 2 or 3 million more who have given up hope and are now no longer in the job-seeking market. The first emphasis needs to be placed on jobs. Another emphasis needs to be placed on low interest rates. Another emphasis needs to be placed on an aggressive sale of American products overseas, on a revision of the tax structure to remove the incentives that have encouraged American multinational corporations to manufacture products overseas when their own employees were out of work here in this country. Another one is the coordination of the horrible, bloated, bureaucratic, confused mess that exist in Washington. So for the first time, the President and the Congress can work together. The federal, state, and local levels of government can work together. And so that the government, industry, labor, manufacturing, agriculture can work together toward common goals. The last thing I might mention is that the people have to have their confidence in this country and its government restored. And they need to be reminded that inherently we are just as strong economically as we were 5 years ago when everything looked rosy. We've got the same capacity for production, the same purchasing power among our consumers, the same potential foreign markets, the same basic natural resources as we had then. We just lost our purpose, lost our confidence in the future.
The future president and former Georgia governor, Jimmy Carter, was a guest on Newsmakers in September of 1975. The moderator was WLSU's Terry Rochester. In January of 1977, Jimmy Carter would be sworn in as the 39th president of the United States. Carter's not the only presidential candidate to appear on Newsmakers. Illinois U.S. Senator Paul Simon, who ran for president in 1988, also appeared on the program. You're listening to a special 40th anniversary episode of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Coming up next, another 1970s Newsmakers interview with psychologist Timothy Leary, whose research into psychedelic drugs made him one of the most controversial figures of the 1960s. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Dr. Timothy Leary's work researching psychedelic drugs made him one of the most interesting and controversial figures of the 1960s. Known for the phrase, turn on, tune in, and drop out, President Richard Nixon once called him the most dangerous man in America. In October of 1977, Leary came to La Crosse as part of a college speaking tour and was a guest on Newsmakers. The start and finish of his time on Newsmakers with a La Crosse media panel was entertaining, to say the least.
You were an early advocate of LSD usage and drug usage and this type of thing. Do you look back?
No, that's not true.
It's a good start.
What's the next question?
Do you look back on that period of time with any recollections of it doing any good?
The 1960s?
Right.
Yeah, I think the 1960s was the most volatile, liberating, important decade in recorded history. I think the first time in recorded history a mass, middle-class, working-class population was given the privilege and the opportunity to do what only the upper class and the elite and the nobility could do before that. That is to define themselves and their own bodies and their own consciousness as the center of their future and their energies. It was the most democratic, liberating era in history. I don't think there's one aspect of American culture that wasn't reviewed, reformed, revised, improved during that decade. So much happened during the 60s, it's going to take us a long time to let the smoke settle and to really appreciate how all of our lives have been changed for the better by that decade.
What sort of things were changed that you saw, or what sort of effects now are coming out in the 70s that you saw developing during the 60s?
Well, I see the 60s as a kind of a flowering period. It was a period of self-discovery. For the first time in history, people like myself said to average working-class Americans, young Americans, you can do it. Drop out. Don't listen to what society tells you. Don't listen to the old worn-out creeds. You make up your own mind. You do your own thing. Now, this meant, you know, when you give people liberty, particularly internal liberty, when you give them the chance to create their own realities, they're going to go in a million ways. So it's true that in the 60s you had all sorts of kooky situations. You had people dressing in wild costumes. You had them hair long, hair short, bald hair. They were dressing like Indians. They were dressing like Hindus. They were dressing like 18th century, that's okay. Because when you give people the courage and the confidence to do what they want, naturally they're going to... And sure, there are a lot of silly things happen. It was a self-indulgent period, but you take that for granted. The great thing about it was sometimes they talk about... There's a nostalgia about the movement of the 60s. If we could only go back to the movement. Well, there was no movement. I was there. I can tell you there was no one movement. There were 1,000 movements. There were as many movements as anyone had hips to shake or had new ideas to shake up in their own minds. Do your own thing. Look within. Find your own inner authentic compass readings and live it out your own way. That was the message as I saw it.
I would like to just ask you what happened to two other key factors of what we, at least, on the receiving end of the national media, understood. We also heard Turn On, which to the national media meant LSD and drugs, and you also took exception with the kind of representation that Paul Lowry said that you advocated. What really happened? What didn't we hear right?
Well, certainly, as scholars and intelligent students of the media that we have assembled in this room, you're hip enough to know that the media gives you exactly what the middle class wants to be told. So you deal in images, you deal in the half-baked, superficial notions. Everything's much more complicated than what the media tells us. It all comes down to human situations. Now, all reporters and journalists want to confront me on the drug issue. Didn't I advocate the use of, shooting alcohol in the vein and so forth? Yes, I said in the 60s, it was your business what you did with your body. Who and what you put in your body was your own business, and the government had nothing to say about it. Sure, your family had the right and the duty to talk over with you how you're going to handle your consciousness, but it was not the affair of the government. Now, as far as drugs are concerned, sure. There was an enormous explosion of drug use in the 60s. I want to point out, though, that America was a drug-taking country before the 60s. Alcohol, 60 million social drinkers or heavy drinkers. Nicotine, we were a drugged-up culture. Valium, you talk about drugs. Marijuana and LSD are way down on the list of the drugs of use in the 60s. People want me to... Do you want me to acknowledge the validity of the drug experience? Many of your listeners want to know what I'm going to say about that. Yes, I flatly acknowledge the validity of the drug experience. Not in general. I'm not advocating drugs. I'm simply pointing out to you that the nervous system is a biochemical instrument, that there are hundreds of drugs that can move your head in any direction you want to move your consciousness. The intelligent person today is sophisticated enough to know there are many options. That's the key, options. You can take any one drug or combination of drugs, or you don't have to take any drugs at all. But you have those options, and these options are what freedom's all about. Sure.
Did you consider yourself a political prisoner during the 60s and up until your recent release from prison?
Was I a political prisoner? Well, I think almost the entire country was involved in political prisonhood during the 60s. You know, Watergate was all about Gordon Liddy trying to bust into the office of Larry O'Brien, the head of the Democratic Party. We all suffered a restriction of our liberties during the 60s. Since I was one of the spokespersons of the 60s, sure, it came down on me a little bit heavier, but we all suffered through that. Yes, I'd say I was the number one political prisoner of the Nixon, Agnew, Liddy, Hoover administration.
Hoover. O.J. Edgar.
Yeah, who'd you think I was talking about?
One never knows Herbert. Because some people would insist that he hasn't died. And his...
Is Herbert Hoover still with us?
talking about the newfound freedom of the 60s, are the American people moving in a positive direction with that in the 70s as far as cultural evolution?
What do you think?
I don't know. I think they're still a little bit fragmented. They haven't, pushed it to a solid point. They aren't pushing.
Well, that's good. I believe in cultural fragmentation. I don't want cultural homogeneity. I don't want us to be an anthill in which we all wore the same kind of clothes and same kind of hair length and, you know, use the same cliches. So I'm all in favor of diversity, and that's the great lesson of the 60s. Okay, let's compare the 60s and the 70s, because I think that's behind your, behind your question. I think that the young people today, the college students today, are more intelligent and more sophisticated by a factor of 100 than those that preceded them. They say that the kids today are laid back and self-indulgent and sensual and just looking after their own affairs. I say great, because you have to learn how to get your own stuff together before you can rush out and change the world. There was too much rhetoric in the late 60s, particularly when the stupid politicians moved in, like Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, who kept saying, never mind feeling good, feel bad, and kill your mother and your father. I mean, that's not what we were saying. We were trying to get everyone together in the 60s. I think that the 70s students aren't buying rhetoric. They're not buying slogans. They're very suspicious about cliches. They are concentrating on their own career, on their own intelligence, on their own style of life. There's a tremendous... I like to say that the 60s was a time of self-discovery. It was wonderful. The first time that any middle-class, working-class had the luxury to discover yourself. Because before the 60s, everyone, your parents, were robots to the system. You know, 8 to 5, 40 years and then on the assembly line and you get a gold watch at the end of it. They were slaves. So that the 60s brought about that great, quiet revolution of self-discovery. Find out who you are. Never mind geography. Let's look at the internal geography. I think the 70s are more sophisticated because it's a period of self-actualization. It's one thing to discover, you know, who you are, but then you got to get to work and do something about it. The kids, they've gone back to work. Of course they should go back to work. But they're not going back to work in the old Horatio Alger sense of killing yourself for GM or for General Electric or for Blatt's beer or whatever it is. They're going back to work now to barter their time for money, to spend that money on snowplows or skis or cocaine or whatever they want to do. It's their business.
You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. We're marking the 40th anniversary of Newsmakers in the La Crosse area with a 1970s interview featuring psychologist and 60s icon Timothy Leary.
I grew up in the 60s and was involved in the student demonstrations, and most of the people involved with me have now turned, as you would say it, into the establishment. The entire people behind the Chicago demonstrations have gone into the establishment.
Yeah.
You haven't.
No.
We feel that we grew up.
Yeah.
That was the reason we did it. What happened in your situation?
I guess I haven't grown up. I want to tell you about the 60s demonstrations. You know, I was never a politician in the 60s. I said then, and I say now, you're a fool if you think that the politicians are going to solve your problems. The politicians aren't going to do that. Certainly we understand that. I think the Carter Ford election was a testimony to the intelligence of the American people. What was it? 53% of the people voted and 47% stayed home. I think that's symptomatic of the fact that we realize that you got to do it yourself, or you got to do it with your friends. There's no welfare state. There's no big brother in Washington that's going to solve either your problems or the government's problems. So that I never got along with the activists in the 60s. The first time I met Jerry Rubin, I realized he's a Boy Scout moron. And he could just as well have been a young Hitler youth, or he could have just as well have been a young communist youth or a young Boy Scout leader. Whatever was conventional, he was going to go out there and say it. So when he was going around saying, kill your mother and your father, he doesn't have a brain in his head. Now he's going around. 15 years later, he's discovered psychology. You know, 15 years ago, I was a psychologist at Harvard. So I don't have much respect for the politics. Did you read that article in Newsweek about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, when all those heavy-duty, big-shot politicians from the 60s admitted that they didn't have a clue as to what they were talking about then? Now they can say it. Rennie Davis, who led the Chicago 7 thing, is selling insurance, and Jerry Rubin's selling bad cocaine.
Is there any way that you would say then that Stokely Carmichael has remained true among all those of the 60s?
Well, I don't believe in staying true. You got to change. I've never stayed in one consistent situation. My Lord, in the last 15 years, we've gone through more changes, more evolutionary metamorphoses. Wow, it's just you just can't stay true to some... That's static Newtonian thinking. You've got to keep awake and alert to new things that are happening, and new things are happening. Within 10 or 15 years, everyone listening to this radio broadcast is going to have the option of going to space, living in big 30-mile-long space worlds in which you'll have ski resorts and three-dimensional tennis clubs and Tahitian villages. Everyone listening to this broadcast, if they're in reasonable health and have reasonable luck, will be able to double or triple their lifespan. So there are a lot of exciting alternatives ahead that should, we've got to understand the past, but the American people and the human race has been backing into the future until very recently. Well, the time is coming, and we can't afford to do that anymore. We've got to look ahead and create the future. And that's the title of my lecture here tonight, The Creation, the Conscious and Intelligent Creation of the Future.
What are you going to do with all these people that are 90, 100, 120 years old? We have a population problem now. We have millions of people on welfare. We have millions of people who can't eat throughout the world. We're just going to be tripling it or doubling it. do you have any solutions for this, or
you
cut
solution.
The people down? Or
I gave
what?
You the solution. Can you think back on what I just said?
Send them off to space?
Yeah. According to Professor Gerard O'Neill of Princeton, top drawer, respectable physicists, and the NASA committees that he's working with, and the blueprints that are being worked out right now by Boeing and Rockwell and the aerospace people, will have more people leaving the planet Earth, migrating from the planet Earth by the year 2020, than we have being born. The situation, my friends, is like 1493. We're going to be leaving. This is the old world. We're going to be building new worlds in space. And as a matter of fact, the longevity, which down here would become a nightmare if you had... people living 300 and 400 years old. Gee, you'd have John Denver and Frank Sinatra singing golden oldies at Caesar's Palace, right? I can't handle that now. But with space colonization, we got plenty of places to go, new worlds to build. We're going to get smarter, so there's a lot to do. But we can't do it on a limited planet, a shrinking planet with a growing population and decreasing energy resources.
If we're looking to expand, though, into space and to other areas and you want to develop out there, what's going to happen to the people left behind? What's going to develop here? Where are we going to go if you're stuck here?
If you don't want to go, you're going to be in exactly the same situation that Europeans were in. We had the same conversation in 1493. I said, listen, we can go over to the New World. Columbus showed we can go there. You say, well, what's going to happen to us? You're all going to go there and leave us here? Sure, you can stay back here if you want. You can go up there and tourist flights. It's going to cost $3,000 round trip. If you like it, stay up there. If you don't want to, come back here, and you can astound the earthlings with your slideshows of what it was like up there. We've been through this before. We've been through it when we left the water and climbed down to the shoreline. When we left Europe and came over here, we're doing it again. We're a restless migrant race, Americans. And by the way, I've become a red, white, and blue all out America, and I think America is the place where the courageous people, the energetic people, the dynamic people, some crook, sure, on run from the law, that's all right. But America has always, at least for the last 300 years, led the way for personal freedom and the kind of electricity that that allows you to be imaginative. So it's that impulse, it's that wave we're still riding.
I see the 60s as a time that just created the mood
yeah.
to accept things like space flight that you're proposing.
Yeah.
Not really a time, as you seem to be suggesting, that make the people more free, more open, more intelligent.
Well, that's a shotgun question. You know, there are a lot of ideas in your question. Certainly, the 60s allowed people to be more free, didn't they? Before the 60s, everybody had to have their hair cut and slicked back, you know, John Dean type. Before the 60s, you had one option. That was to get drunk on Saturday night. Before the 60s, you know, it was Eisenhower years. So you can't deny that the 60s opened up a liberation of lifestyle, can you?
I might, in terms of the same type of social pressure used to get people to have long hair and smoke marijuana or take LSD that the children of the 60s used. It was the same as the type of pressure their parents used to get them to slick their hair back and get drunk on Saturday nights.
I see. So you're saying that the 60s was just another form of conformity?
I'm asking you if you see it that way.
Well, we did learn from the 60s that everybody lives in their own reality bubble, that your brain creates your world, my brain creates mine. Certainly my reality bubble is different from yours. I think that the divergency of lifestyle, my Lord, you had people going off to India, you had people going to South America, you had people going to the countries, you had people joining these hundreds of sects and cults and Jesus freaks and guru freaks and swami freaks and, you know, you name it, there's not one porthole of the body that doesn't have a Bible and a guru. I think that the 60s did open things up. Now, what was the rest of your question?
Well, I wanted to see if you really believe that the 60s was so unique that since that point in time, people will be more intelligent. That's what you're implying.
The 60s was not very intelligent. It was more a time of self-indulgent exploration. I'd say the 70s is a period of breakthrough intelligence. See, the long-haired kids of the 60s, 10 years ago, are now 10 years older, and they're running their research laboratories. They're running the police departments. They're running the, they're running the White House. The kids around Carter were stealing hubcaps and running rock concerts in Atlanta, Georgia 10 or 15 years ago. So, I think there's a realization now that just getting loaded, just getting high, just feeling good is no ultimate solution. What we said in the 60s and what I say again right now is get as high as you can get. But remember, the higher you get, the more precise your navigation has to be.
Are you sorry that it took a PhD to get where you are?
I'm not sorry about anything.
One question about you. You're talking about the 60s as a time of consciousness and breakthroughs and various things, and most, you use the term middle class America, look at the 60s at a period of time where sexual mores broke down, kids willingly and wantonly broke the law by smoking marijuana and taking LSD and taking drugs. Do you think that this is good? Because now we've gotten to the 70s where it's accepted for this new sexual promiscuous whatever, taking a marijuana, the whole bit, the whole trip. Is this worth it? Or are we losing something?
What
the American ideal, if you want to put it that way.
The American ideal, as I see it, what you are calling the American ideal is the South American ideal. The American ideal is, number one, a nose-thumbing attitude towards centralized authority, a distrust of militarism, and a glorification of do-your-own-thing. It's a pioneer, frontier notion of get out there and live your own way. William Penn founded Pennsylvania because he didn't like the Church of England. Lord Calvert, the Catholic, founded Maryland because he wanted to be free. The Pilgrim Fathers didn't like what the guys in City Hall were doing, so they were literally exiles and fugitives and lawbreakers, to use your phrase, to come in those leaky boats and come over here. The Mormons, Joseph Smith was a lawbreaker who had to head out of town with his crew to go across the perilous prairies in his spaceships. We're a country of people who thumb their nose at any bureaucrat. We hate bureaucrats. We glorify in the individual the loner that's willing to go off and do his own thing. It's the American tradition, and this business of centralized law enforcement and so forth, that's exactly what our foremothers and fathers fought for. And I encourage all your listeners to remember you're the seed descendants of dissidents and outlaws and rebels that wanted to head west because they wanted to do their own thing. And goodbye to City Hall. Listen, I've only brought to Wisconsin about 24 pieces of wisdom, and I've run out of them now. Okay, I really don't have any more left. I've got a lecture to give. My voice is giving out. I thank your intelligent interest. I thank you for inviting me here, but I really think I better wander off now.
Dr. Timothy Leary ended his visit to Newsmakers and the questioning with a La Crosse media panel in the fall of 1977 very abruptly. With a few minutes left in the show and to fill the time, the staff at WLSU played the song Legend of a Mind by the Moody Blues, which contains the lyric, Timothy Leary's dead. Leary did die in 1996 at age 75. The moderator for that interview was WLSU's then public affairs director, Jack Marlowe. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to a website with details about Timothy Leary's work. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows and photos, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers. Yeah.